Hello and welcome to Differential Discussions. I'm Melissa. And today we have a guest back with us. Mr. David McGlasson is back to share with us an interesting case study and some research that he has done. So welcome back, Dave.
Thank you, Melissa. Dave, it's good to see you also. Good to be back. Today I'm going to talk to you about something that actually just popped up about a year ago when I was reading a journal article by J.R. Greenmeyer et al. Out of Mayo Clinic. And he presented a very interesting case report about a child with a prosthetic mitral valve. And this was in case reports at Mayo Clinic's proceedings. And I'm reading along, and they're having trouble anticoagulating this child, kept tossing clots, and because it had a mechanical valve, and they had it on what they thought was oral anticoagulated therapy range using warfarin. By the way, we can't say Coumadin in the United States anymore. They lost their trademark, so it's warfarin now. And the name originally came from the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, warfarin. So, we're using that term. But this child, they had trouble anticoagulating. It kept tossing clots, kept having issues. They tried bivalirudin. And then one of the hematologists suggested they use a chromogenic factor 10 assay. Well, as I'm reading this, and they talked about the range that they used. And all of a sudden they said, and this was done by McGlasson et al. In a research protocol at Wolfert Hall Medical Center. I'm going, okay, I'm being cited right here, and I didn't even know it. And they used the ranges that we established on this procedure, the chromogenic factor 10 assay, to anticoagulate the child. Now, I'm going to take you through a bit about what we did to get to this point. I did the original 510K work for the FDA through a company called DiaPharma to validate the chromogenic factor 10 assay. Where I used to work at the 59th Clinical Research Division at Wolfert Hall Medical Center, companies would come to us and get us to try new equipment, new reagent, instrument combinations, new types of kits, and various aspects of blood coagulation. This one is one that I did for DiaPharma. I first worked it up as a microtiter method. And then I got to where another FDA validation on coagulation instrumentation, and particular the Stago system setups. So the title of this part of the presentation, the comparison of a chromogenic factor 10 assay to international normalized ratio for monitoring oral anticoagulation therapy. And what we used was the what we called then the Coumadin Clinic. Now it's called the Anticoagulation Clinic at Wolfert Hall Medical Center, which is monitors a lot of retired military personnel and their dependents at Wolfert Hall. And I had some really good people helping me on it. I had a resident by the name of Ben Romick, who was a very sharp guy, and he needed a research protocol, so I put him on it. And it worked out very well. Also, probably the most brilliant biostatistician I've ever worked with, Dr. Bernard Rubel, who used to be at Brooke Army Medical Center at Fort Sam Houston, which is also in San Antonio, where I happened to be stationed when I was in the Army back 100 years ago. The INR, of course, is the primary method for monitoring patients on oral anticoagulation therapy and for people on particularly a warfarin. And there's limitations to it. After all, it can have a lupus anticoagulant interference. When you're converting somebody to direct thrombin inhibitors, I use my hands and you can't see them here, but they're there. When you're converting DTIs to oral anticoagulation therapy, because you can't keep them on there a long time, and also people with dysfibrinogen anemias, where their fibrinogen molecule is just breaking all down. Now, the chromogenic 10 assay has been validated for use in monitoring patients with LAs who are on oral anticoagulation therapy. Several investigators have done this. A gentleman that I know really well, Dr. Tom Ortel, with Dr. Stefan Mall, first started this research back in the late 1990s, And also a fellow that I've done some work with, Dr. Terry Rossborough, who was at Aline Hospital up in Minneapolis. He has since moved on from there, have looked at this, but they did not look at it in the way that we did, with validations of the methods on patients who were on oral anticoagulants in a large population. Now, the good thing about this test, like the PTINR, it's not affected by the presence of an LA or direct thrombin inhibitors, the dysfibrinogenemias that we talked about, and other variables that might affect the INR. Now, of course, since it is a photo-optic method, things like a high bilirubin, icteric samples, lipemia, yeah, that can still interfere. But to date, before we did it, it had never been compared to the INR in monitoring a large population like we did. In fact, it was very interesting. Our Pino in like 2008 tested on 62 patients in his study, and but they did it on a very limited group of people who were all on anticoagulation. I did it on 330 some odd patients, including normals, people who were in all different ranges, therapeutic, subtherapeutic, supratherapeutic. And so but to date we did not have a what they call a universally defined range of values for this. Now, this is an example here that you see of individuals who had worked this up before, but like I said, their population groups were limited, and they did not look at especially supratherapeutic ranges, except for MOL in this population here, where they went therapeutic range is usually 2 to 3. On mechanical heart valves, it's usually a 2.5 to 3.5 on the INR. You can see here, though, that the chromogenic factor 10 works in percentages. And I kind of equate it to the same thing like you see with an anti-factor 10A test for monitoring people on heparinoids. This gives you a number, not a range, but it gives you a specific number, like it would give you a number for glucose testing on where a person is. And then you can fit that to their INRs. Now, the object of our study was to define the therapeutic range and assess the relationship between the chromogenic 10 and the INR values in our outpatient anticoagulation setting. Now, the one thing about this is that we did not know something when we first started working with this about what happens to the INR after it hits a point of, like, say, 4. And we'll show you some very interesting data on that. Very, very limited on what would happen with supratherapeutic people. Back in, oh gosh, it's been several years ago, I did a study where I was looking at Yucatan miniature swine on oral anticoagulation. They were going to be a model for a new type of cryo biopsy technique. Because the pulmonologist found out that they were having a lot of problems going in and doing lung biopsies on people who were on warfarin. You mess up in the lung with somebody on warfarin, you got a real problem. And what all of a sudden I noticed was that I'd get these pigs, and pigs are very similar to humans, probably in more ways than we care, but cardiovascular wise, and also in anticoagulating them with warfarin. Well, I'd get the pig into the range, and all of a sudden it would shoot up to, instead of being in 2.5 to 3.5, where we were shooting, trying to shoot for, it would go up to 8, 18, 31. And back then we were using systems that some of your older techs will remember that were used by everybody. They were MLA coagulation systems, and we couldn't figure it out. Now, that was a photo-optic system. When we switched, though, to a system that is clot-based, endpoint type thing, mechanical type of coagulation, that all went away. And it also explained, they found out that it explained why people were coming into the ER with an INR of 8, and they'd give them vitamin K, and then they'd thrombose, and they couldn't figure out why that was happening. It really wasn't 8, and we'll show you that in a little bit. But RNI values were correlated to the chromogenic factor 10 for determining the following ranges for these patients on oral anticoagulant therapy: subtherapeutic, which was defined as less than 2, therapeutic 2 to 3, super therapeutic, greater than three, and of course, our normals. We use the STAR Evolution automated system from Diagnostic Astago. The chromogenic factor 10 assay is only available in this country that FDA cleared with Diapharma. Another company has it, but it's never been FDA cleared for use in the United States. The INR performed with PT method using Neoplasm CI Plus with an international sensitivity index of 1.28, and importantly, the geometric mean of 13.8 seconds. And it's important that you use the geometric mean. It gives you a better definition of what the information is telling you on the entire group that you're measuring. The INR uses a very interesting formula, and people have really messed it up over time. For example, some people, when they first started using it, took it times the ISI. Like, for example, you had a one, and then they take it times 1.28. It's the power that you look for. You don't look, you take it times it. The formula, it starts breaking down, as I'll show you a little bit later. We use some very sophisticated statistics. I won't give a class in statistics on this, but we used software from SigmaPlot. Overall correlation of INR to CFX was assessed with an inverse square method. The goodness of fit using the coefficient of determination, or R square, we're all familiar with that. We also use something that's become very popular in the last few years, the receiver operator curve characteristic. This actually came out of radar, but it discriminates on how close your data fits under this, what they call rock area. And highly discriminative is greater than 0.9, and 0.8 is still good discrimination. Now, if you get like a 50-50, it's like either or, and it doesn't really tell you much of anything, except you might be right and you might be wrong. And I'll show you some actual pictures of that. The chromogenic 10 ranges consistent with INR therapeutic ranges were defined by plots of sensitivity and specificity. The Kolmogorov, which I have a hard time pronouncing, and Smirnov test was employed to assess normality of the chromogenic 10 distributions on the therapeutic subsets. And what that means is it's information acquired by scientists through experimentation and observation. It's a goodness of fit test, and it establishes a special case of testing for normality of your distribution. Now, in other words, you got actual data there, not professional opinion, like a lot of people come up with. And non-normally distribution data was presented as median and 25th and 75% percentiles that we used. We use the analysis of variance, which is used anytime you're looking at more than two things instead of a t-test or a whole bunch of t-tests. And then on the Dunn Hock post-hoc test, or Bonferroni's is sometimes used. It's a statistical procedure used to compare multiple pairs of means or averages in a group of data. And anything that was less than 0.05 were considered insignificant. We had 309 randomly selected patients who were on oral anticoagulated therapy. Our Coumadin clinic also, Coumadin, I said it, I'm sorry. Our warfarin clinic, block that. Our warfarin clinic was very, very good. There were a number of papers written a few years ago. In fact, George Fritzma, who you just had on recently, talking about von Willebrand's disease, and I were discussing this. A few papers were written a few years ago where warfarin clinics were happy if they had people, 60% of the people in their population were in therapeutic range. And that was a big problem. It's hard to keep people on warfarin because of all kinds of things can interfere with it. What? Our clinic would start having panic attacks if they got below 80% of the people in range. They were monitored very, very closely, and they really did a good job. I have to hand it to them. I've been in other places where, yeah, not so good. In fact, they were sometimes, I can't name those places, but sometimes they were happy if it was 50%. And but our people went through a very rigorous training class before they were put on the drug, and then they had to come in at least monthly to be checked. And okay, what's your diet? What are you what kind of medications are you on? Because a lot of them can interfere with it. And it was a really good monitoring system. Now, 30 normal subjects not on anticoagulants were tested for comparison. And these were people who were not on any types of anticoagulant blood thinners of any kind whatsoever, even aspirin. The range of the INR in the oral anticoagulant patients were 0.92 to 12.76. 12.76 is very, very high. That's way up there on a critical value. Our critical values were anything above a 4.5. We called it that. The chromogenic range was 9 to 132%. This was the 12.5 guy. And 132% was one of the normals. Now, the results, and we got in the range here, looking at the numbers. Okay, less than 2, 70%, 70 of the group had a range of a mean of 53%. The 2 to 3 range had 28%. And this was 135 patients. Greater than 3 out of 104 patients was 21%. And our normal range was what, your normal range is like 50 to 150 is what, people just kind of throw that out there. Our average was 96%. And in this group, and it went from 72 to 131%. And this is talking about what they call percent activity. All right, now this is what's really cool. This is the percentile of the chromogenic factor 10. These are the INRs here. We've got a range of 0 to 14 and 0 to 200% activity. All of the non-filled in areas, the open circles, are normal patients. The closed ones are people who are on anticoagulation therapy. Now, look what happens to this curve. It goes down here, you get in the therapeutic range, and then when it hits 4, it flattens out. Now, so you've got people here with an INR of, let's say, 7. That's in the therapeutic range as far as the chromogenic factor 10. This is what I was talking about when we were talking about individuals who were coming into the ERs with INRs off the charts, giving them vitamin K and then clotting. It is not accurate after you get above 4. It flattens out every single time. And I'm trying to find my arrow here. And, okay. Dr. Terry Rossborough, who I mentioned earlier, actually did a similar study where he was looking at factor 2s and factor 10s. And he got the exact same type of curve that we did. And that's never been described before. So we were very, very happy with what we got. And it showed that, again, can you trust the INR in certain patients? And is that elevated value accurate? Low ones, yeah. Here in the 2 to 3 range, yeah, or 2 and up to 4. You've got a pretty good correlation here, but after that, forget it. The normals are all in the range that they should be. Here was the guy with 132%. Here was the fellow out here with the 10.5 that had the 9% activity, which is very low and puts them at risk for bleeding. Now, here's the ROC curve. This is the 50% or 0.5 area. It's either here, where our group was, and what you see here. And figure 2A, which is this one, the threshold of therapeutic anticoagulation, and it's a plot of sensitivity and specificity over the range. And this is of, all the people that we looked at, but it's under the curve. And what you look at is this area up here, and it's up under in that area of 0.984. So you've got extremely good specificity there. When you come over here and look at the arrow in this range, this is the group that has the INR of greater than 2. So the person with an INR of 2 has a 35.5% chromogenic factor 10. See where the arrow crosses there? Like right here. You follow it up where these cross. That's how you calculate that out. Now, in this one, where you're looking at the specificity, the area under the curve is 0.864. Remember, we said 0.8 or above is good. Where it came out to where the arrow is greater than 3, you've got a 23.5 consistent percent consistency with an INR of more than 3 is in this range here. So they use our range of 23.5, 35.5, and shot for 30%. That gives you, Melissa, you need to check on something? You okay? All right. Melissa is doing yeoman work today, people. I appreciate it. But you've got an area here now where we know what range that the person should be on. Now, you can see this also with these box descriptions here, where you look at the 10th and the 90th percentile for the chromogenic factor 10 values, and it's between 23.5 and 35.5. And it shows the numbers that are, this is, your numbers that are in the therapeutic and supertherapeutic range and the subtherapeutic range. And the analysis on the ranks was statistically significant. And it was also less than 0.05 here on the 2 to 3. See, this dashed lines indicate this range, and it's equivalent to the INR therapeutic range of 2 to 3. Okay. Now, conclusion before we get into the case study. Chromogenic 10 correlates well with INR in a randomly selected group of oral anticoagulation patients at varying levels of concentration of anticoagulation. The R value is 0.964. The chromogenic 10 is highly discriminated for patients in therapeutic and subtherapeutic INR ranges, where our ROC curve was 0.948, and that was in the entire group. Now, it has good discrimination for patients in therapeutic and supertherapeutic INR range, where we had the ROC curve of 0.864, and that was on 240 of the patients that were in the group. So, less than 35.5% appears to be equivalent to an INR of 2. Sensitivity 91.7, specificity 91.9. And again, the chromogenic 10 suggests supertherapeutic anticoagulation equivalent to an INR of 3 at 23.5%. So these are our ranges here for anticoagulation. Sensitivity and specificity also correlated with what you saw on the charts earlier. So our current findings suggest usefulness of the chromogenic 10 for monitoring oral anticoagulation in a broad group of patients seen in a warfarin clinic. Further studies are warranted, and they still haven't been done yet, really, in the way that they should be, to compare outcomes in patients with bleeding events, thromboembolism, and it does cost a little bit more than doing a PT-INR. It costs about as much as doing maybe an anti-10A, a little bit cheaper, actually. The convenience, do you keep it around for that special patient that's giving you the problem? Well, and the availability of it, not a lot of labs do it. What I suggest is scrap the PT-INR, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But before we do that, let's go into an actual patient where we can see what actually went on, what the docs did, and how it affects everything. This is anticoagulation of a young child with a mechanical heart valve replacement that required oral anticoagulation using warfarin under current guidelines. And this was in 2022. The subjects really require lifelong monitoring of adjusted medication. And especially on a child, that's really hard to do, because they're growing. Everything's changing. They're not stable as far as their habits and stuff yet. Direct oral anticoagulants and heparinoids are not approved yet today for monitoring a pediatric patient or any patient with a mechanical type of a prosthesis. Biologics, yes, but not with a mechanical valve. The subject had an acute valvular thrombosis despite receiving warfarin dose that should have had the INR range value in the therapeutic range for mechanical heart valves, which is a little bit higher in 2.5 to 3.5. The INR values for 2 months were between 2.0 and 4.7, so it was kind of all over the place. The child had a number of symptoms, as you can see here, that causing a lot of issues for it, but there was no affection present. Now, one thing that's kind of interesting is they never did find out what was causing this problem. It wasn't a lupus anticoagulant. It wasn't something else that might do it. Most of the INR values were in therapeutic range, with some subtherapeutic and one supertherapeutic. Bivalirudin was given, and it only made matters worse. PT and PTT were elevated with a normal factor five level, and they did the factor five to rule out if there was any liver issue, because that can cause a lot of problems with coagulation if your liver is not functioning properly. Now, the chromogenic 10 level was 47% activity, which corresponded to them to an INR of 2.2, but it's subtherapeutic for this type of condition. So, hematology suggested using the chromogenic 10 assay to get a range of 20 to 30% activity, so the INR range would be adjusted to 3 to 4. Now, after the target range was met using our ranges that we set up and the chromogenic factor 10 that they got from Diapharma, the patient was monitored for a year with no problems. Now, that's extraordinary. A normal echo showed normal AVV valve function, and no evidence of thrombosis or bleeding was apparent. So, in this patient, the cause of the failure to achieve the INR therapeutic range, as I said, was never detected when using a PT-INR testing, putting the subject at risk. The chromogenic method, remember, bypasses the in vitro pathways that may give falsely elevated or, in some cases, decreased INR values. The chromogenic 10 method can overcome the presence of, like we said earlier, of lupus anticoagulants, direct thrombin inhibitors, interference, and dysfibrinogen anemias. So the chromogenic 10 assay can be used when the INR is found unreliable. Universal ranges for equivalent INR therapeutic ranges have still not been established. However, several other excellent studies have been accomplished, and people are still looking at this, but again, they are not, how can I say it? They're not using it enough, except in special anticoagulation clinics. Now, Greenmeyer in 2021 used, was the guy who I read the case report of, and it used our study, suggested used prior suggested ranges that had correlated therapeutic ranges on the case report we just related, and that was ours. Alpino used it, but again, they only had 62 patients, and their ranges were higher than ours. And this is one where we wrote where we conducted the study with the 339 patients that we went over with. It came out to work very well for this patient. We looked at the super therapeutic ranges, and in this case study, an INR corresponded to a chromogenic 10 level of 47%, which they found was not accurate. And the subject with the thrombotic issues required a level of 35% to attain an INR of 3.5. Now, my opinion, why not just use the chromogenic 10 to monitor the subjects on oral anticoagulant therapy? Use the 10 like we monitor the heparinoids and the DOACs, using an anti-10A test. And you don't have to use you can use a special calibrators for it. Works just as well. You still use the PT to measure your clottable factor assays, like the 2, 5, 7, and 10 one-stage factor assays. And you can use the chromogenic 10 also, like we do the chromogenic 8 and 9 methods, which a lot of people have gone to, in particular because it doesn't, no inhibitors, even the coagulation factor inhibitors don't bother it. So we won't have to worry about interfering substances, except in the pre-analytical variables such as elevated, like I said, elevated bilirubins, hemolysis, and lipemia. Labs could set up the 10 just like the anti-10A methods and compare the clotting corresponding methods to establish ranges to determine time and range for therapeutic levels. And that's about it from my standpoint. The thing that would take away from this is you saw how it works, and it's been done on a lot of people now with mechanical heart valves that have interfering substances. And like I said, it really surprised me. They never did really find out why in this child it had a unstable INR. And I actually reached out to Dr. Greenmeyer, and he never hasn't answered me yet. And because I said I wanted to find out if they actually had some type of information. I have written this up in two different parts, and you can get this on a you can go to a Diapharma website and look for something called, or you could just type in something called Clot Club, and I've written it up in the chromogenic 10 on how it's used, and I also wrote it up because this way, this shows that you can individually correlate or individually design a therapeutic pattern for somebody who's got a problem using this test. Whereas with the PT-INR, it's hard to do. You can't do it just like one for an individual because there's too many variables in there. I'd like to thank, I also like to thank the guys, Ben Romick and Dr. Rubel. Dr. Rubel has just retired. I called him. I said, you might want to listen in on this today. And he got back to me and said he would try. He was actually out of the country though, so might not have made it. But this was some of, I think, the best work that I ever did. We presented this at the American Heart Association, and also there is a anticoagulation forum. I gave a poster at this. It was supposed to be 30 minutes. I stood there for 2.5 hours. And the people from Diapharma had to run out and keep getting copies of the poster because these people said, man, we haven't heard of this. We got to get into this. We see this problem a lot. And so that was a few years ago, but like I said, it was something that started out just as a method validation that has about six publications have come out of it in this work altogether. Do I have any questions from the gallery?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And I think your point is well taken about trying to get away from the PT in the sense that there's a lot of different variables that can interfere with it that aren't related to the hemostatic condition of the patient. I do find some that flatness in the curve, and this could be like a lack of understanding on my part, but I do find that flatness towards those high INRs to be a little troubling because it would appear to me like above four, you basically don't know what the INR is.
Above four? No, above four, you know what it is because it correlates very well. It's where, oh, excuse me. You said above four. I was thinking,
It
okay.
looks
Yeah,
really
you're elevated. Yeah,
solid. Yeah, it
right.
looks really
You
solid
don't
in
know.
sub.
You don't know. Yeah, you're right. That was the thing. And that was what I was saying. We have these patients, and like I said, they were bleeding. By warfarin is probably one of the biggest things that can, that occurs in an ER. I mean, we get a lot of them, and they did not know that they weren't handling it right because they weren't getting the right numbers. And like I said, Rossborough got the exact same thing as we did. He actually did a very interesting study where he compared factors 2 and 10, and he found also that if you didn't go back and reevaluate the person after a month's time, that the ranges really shifted and they had to switch their therapeutic ranges out. And I found that really fascinating. But each one of them had that curve that gives, it looks almost like a Nike swoop, doesn't it? You know, and but we, in every study that did similar types of data that we did, it that has come out, and it still fascinates me because I had no clue. In fact, when I got it, I called our Dr. Rubel and I said, "Bernie, what am I looking at here?" He said, and he told me, and I go, "Okay." He said, "It's not what you expected, is it?" He thought I thought it was bad. I said, "No, man, you've hit something that I totally didn't expect." And when we correlated them up, we see these people with elevated INRs with normal chromogenic factor 10s and vice versa. It was just bizarre, you know, what we saw. And like I said, you saw these people when you went across. Well, let me go back to see if I can. Okay. This is the slide you're thinking of, right, Dave? Yeah. Look at this. You've got somebody here who's got the same level of chromogenic 10 that a person with an INR of 7 has. That's
Yeah,
critical to
so
you.
that's what so that's what that's what's funny to me is like on the bench on an INR, that's a called critical value, bring the patient in, but
Right.
then off of the chromogenic factor 10, it's like, oh, so I think you alluded to it too, getting a study that looked at outcomes, right? Like, let's get some
Yes.
Chromogenic factor 10 levels with outcomes, bleeding, clotting, what have you. That would be really fascinating. I think.
I know it's the one thing, and I actually did a lit search. There have been a few where they've done you went back and took a look at data over a year's time, and try to correlate it, but with actual live patients, you know, they haven't done that yet. You
Yeah.
know, and, you know, it was all retrospective type of data, and there weren't enough chromogenic tens done along with that. They just, you know, pumped the people for whatever they could and got them to stop bleeding, you know, that type of thing. But like I said, a lot, I did get a lot of response on that, especially when they were doing reversals. They finally just said, "Okay, hold the dose, support them, and then hold the dose, and then let's see what it is." And that was very enlightening in that respect. Probably saved a lot of people with, you know, being treated with very expensive drugs and putting them at risk even more. So.
It's definitely fascinating, and hopefully this is that first piece to maybe have outcome trials sort of happen, right?
Absolutely.
And that would be very enlightening. And yeah, and maybe we can finally be done with the
Yeah.
PTINR.
Well, here's the thing. Back, oh gosh, probably in 2002, I did a study with using 12 different reagent instrument combinations with PT reagents, and on using a photo optic. I used it three di we did it in three different laboratories where we used photo optic, mechanical, and a laser optic type system with all kinds of different thromboplastins. And it was amazing. We had to do local calibrations of the ISIs in order to get correlations. And it was quite a study. And we found out that, wow, we're out there in no man's land. We're turning out data that really isn't that good unless you do this. Okay, we got to locally calibrate the ISI and we got to correlate this. And it was a lot of data. And like I said, thromboplastins now, for the most part, they're down to rabbit brain and recomboplastin type material. But there are still some that are placental based. I don't think anybody uses brain anymore. I'm not sure. I've been away for a few years on that. So you can see that we're still on the precipice, you know. But like, I agree with you. Let's get rid of the PT for this thing, for God's sake. You know, we can. You know, get rid of these other variables and make sure the patient just give them what's our job? It's to give them a better number, the physicians to treat the patients, right? Okay.
Yeah, I
Well,
think a lot more comfort following like an outcome study, and this looks pretty solid. Yeah.
hope I didn't talk too fast. I had a lot to get through.
No, it was. I mean, I appreciate some bit of brevity, right? Like, and no, it was great. And then the other thing I would be curious about too is what like a precision study looks like. for the chromogenic factor 10, just to see how well the precision holds, especially at like low levels.
Precision at lower levels is very good. That's what the rock curve's telling you.
Cool. Yeah.
It was great. CVs were really tight on this type of thing. On the microtiter method, like I said, if I had a CV that was that was more than 5%, man, it would be some problem going on that I had to go back and troubleshoot. Very good.
It's really neat. Good.
Thank
Thank
you.
you.
I think the
All
other
right.
thing that's great about this presentation is that it can make people think, students, people in the field, what else can I do? How else can I try to impact patient care? Or what can we think and what can we do about the assays that we're running in-house? Not just here, let me run and report results, which is important, but also think about outside of the box, what else can you do?
Instead of just pushing a button and getting a number and then putting it in the box, and send it on its way.
That's the neat thing too, Dave, is like this assay is there, it's on the market, and we're finding a different use case for it, which is just great.
Well, we did the same thing when we started the anti factor 10As. We were still using the PT and PTT, and then long behold, the low molecular weight heparins came out, and you couldn't use the PTT, so you had to come up with something else. And then the DOACs came out, and we said, "Ah, we can use this because these are anti-10A drugs." Okay, we can, but we have to have calibrators for it. Well, and here's an example on the. I'll throw in heparin real quick here. There's about five different heparinoids out there, and we had all kinds of trouble when we first started with this, because we, they would come down, they would order a factor X, or thinking it was a factor 10, thinking it was the same as the anti-factor 10A. And then I had one day, I was talking to a nurse who, I said, "You don't really want a factor 10, do you? You don't have someone up there with a real a rare factor defect or swallowed rat poison or something." And she goes, "No." And I'm not saying this to be, we were having a communication problem because of language too. And I said, "So what type of heparin are you monitoring?" "Heparin." I said, "Well, is it unfractionated? Is it low molecular weight? What is it? There's about five of them." "Heparin." And she hung up on me. So I had to go send a resident up to the floor and find out what type of heparin they were on. And we had only single calibrators at the time. Well, talking with a colleague by the name of Dan Kayser, I said, "You know what? Shouldn't we be able to combine these?" And I did a study where we combined the low molecular weight and the unfractionated using a single calibrator curve. That way, we didn't have to worry about what came down from the floor. We could just turn out the number and send it back, and they could treat them, and on the numbers that we got. And since that time, every major company is now using a single calibration curve with liquid calibrators now, for the most part, and they got it down to three. We had it at six. So that was something that came about by just, okay, we shouldn't have to deal with this. Let's think of something better. And that's something Melissa was just talking about. That actually took place, and I think that paper's been cited about 200 times now, using a single calibration or a hybrid curve for monitoring people on heparin.
A valuable switch. Well,
Sorry, I'm
thanks
getting
so
old,
much.
man. I can't jump back in on this stuff,
You still got it, man.
Anything else?
I'm good. What about you, Melissa?
Everything. So, Dave, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate you coming on and sharing your research and your knowledge with us.
I'm glad to do it. Have a good day.
Thank
And
you.
everybody else, thanks for
Bye.
listening.
Thanks for your time.